Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And g'day, I'm Emma Stratt and I'm currently coming to you from Gungaloo Country in Queensland. And before we dive into the conversation today, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connection to land, sea and community.
The Lentil Intervention is an Australasian educational and advocacy platform dedicated to raising awareness about the current climate and health crisis.
And on this podcast, we invite guests to chat about topics that will inspire you to take action to improve your own health and the health of the planet.
So please subscribe to and share this podcast and visit our website for the full show notes.
And don't forget to buy us a coffee if you'd like to support our work.
Season 2, Episode 41, following on from the last episode with Fuchsia Goldsmith, we bring you another recording from the Evidence-Based Eating New Zealand series of health-focused public lectures. Episodes 18 to 20 were the Dunedin-based lectures, episodes 30 to 32 were Christchurch, and the Auckland theme was focused on hospitals, held on the 9th of October. Due to the lockdown, this was streamed online, and we have for you the audio presentation.
In this episode, we bring you the recording of Professor Boyd Swinburne's presentation. Here he discusses the obesogenic landscape and how our district health boards and government policy can help change things. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out Boyd's previous podcast episode with us, which was Season 2, Episode 8. It was a good one.
Kia ora tātou. So thanks very much for that introduction, and good to have Fuchsia's discussion about the nutrients, and I'm going to take people up to a bit of a higher level. Sorry, Grant, I'm not going to talk about hospitals. I left hospitals some time ago as an endocrinologist treating obesity. I've now shifted into population nutrition, and just from the stories that we heard at the outset, I'm not that keen to get back into hospitals anytime soon. So let me just share my screen with you, and I'm going to talk about fixing the obesogenic landscape. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time about our mental models, how we think about food, how we think about food systems, how we think about diets, food environments, because how we think about it, our mental models are actually fundamental to what the food systems are, what food systems are created, and therefore what food environments we have to choose from. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about policy and how we overcome the policy inertia, things that are happening internationally and things that we're doing in New Zealand to try to get better food policies. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about mobilising community action and a few things that I'm involved with. So if you're interested in health and non-communicable diseases, as Fuchsia's just talked about, I do think this concept of ultra-processed foods is a new concept. It is actually a new way of thinking about food, and I think it is actually really valuable. So probably 35 to 40% of our diet comes from these things called ultra-processed foods, which are in industrial formulations which have come from originally foods, or a lot of them were plants, but corn and sugar and wheat and rice and so on. But they've been extracted, they've been commodified, they have lost all of their structure, they get industrially produced and with a lot of additives into products which have long shelf life, which are ultra palatable and which are heavily marketed and very profitable. And that whole constellation of things around these ultra-processed foods means that they are increasingly dominant in our food supply, taking up, as I said, more than a third of our diet. Now, the point about ultra-processed foods is that if you look at the data around the world, these are the things that are related to the non-communicable diseases outcomes. So if you're worried about health, these are the things we need to try to get out of our diet. If you're worried about the planet and how we're going to reduce the impact of our diets on planet, then these are the things that you'd be worried about, particularly beef and dairy. And if you're worried about our food systems and the state of food depletion of resources, then fish is a big issue. So you can see these are quite different sets of foods to have kind of concern about if you're wanting to have a healthy and sustainable diet. But as the theme for this symposium suggests, that actually a whole food plant-based diet is one that actually ticks all of those boxes. So I just want to now just focus a little bit on the way that we think about food, the way we think about people and diets and food environments. So this model, this kind of onion skin model of how we think about it, is one that I was not brought up with, but in my training, we have an individual in front of us that might have diabetes or obesity. And so we would be thinking about that individual person, their behavior, their diet, their education, their genes, their metabolism, all sorts of things about that individual, which is part of the picture of why they've come here with their diabetes or obesity. But of course, that's not the totality of the person. They are part of social networks, and that has influence on them. And that therefore is part of what's in front of you as well. But also the places that they work, the places that they are educated, where they shop, the foods available, all of those environmental settings at the meso environment level, they have an influence on that person as well. And of course, those things, what's available in your supermarket, is determined by the food system. And the food system, in turn, is determined by government policies and the dollars that flow, norms and expectations, and so on. So this is the way that we traditionally, within health, look at an individual, recognizing the individual and their attributes, but realizing that they are influenced by a wide number of external things. So this is actually really, these individual-centric models are very helpful for explaining some things, like why does this person have obesity or diabetes and somebody doesn't, but they're not very helpful in explaining why is every single country in the world experiencing increases in diabetes. This kind of individual-centric model doesn't really help us to explain that. And that was a question and an issue that was put to us at the Lancet Commission on Obesity, which, as Grant mentioned, we published in 2019. We were given the task by Lancet to come up with something new and different and kind of ground-changing in obesity. So we couldn't go back over all of the old territory. So we had to rethink what we meant by obesity and what these mental models were. And we took that socio-ecological model, this one here, and we turned it inside out. And that was our starting point. So we said, okay, what we need to put right at the center of what we pay attention to is our natural systems. That's where everything comes from. And if we don't have that central within our view, within our world, and it's not a common European perspective, it might be part of Te Ao Māori and other indigenous populations, but it's not the way we think. Natural systems at the center, and then the human created systems, let's put the most important one at the center, which is governance. Who's got the power? Who's making the decisions? Who's calling the shots on the policies and the dollars? Because that then influences our macro systems, like our food systems, that influences our food environments, that influences us. And what we want to get out of our food systems are these four things: human health and well-being, social equity, economic prosperity, and ecological health and well-being. And unfortunately, our food systems are not delivering on those. For New Zealand, it might well be delivering on economic prosperity, and for some, it's improving health and well-being, but it is ruining our environment and has big socioeconomic gradients and is ruining the health of many people as well. So what we tried to say is this obesity thing that we're focused on is actually joined up with undernutrition, and it's joined up with climate change. And we call this the global syndemic. So you may not have heard of a syndemic before, but a syndemic is where there's two or more diseases, or in this case, pandemics, that co-occur in place and time, that negatively interact with each other, and they have common underlying drivers. And this is the point we wanted to get to, is we've got all of this effort in trying to deal with obesity in one part of society. We've got all this effort to try and deal with undernutrition, or in a country like New Zealand, food insecurity in another part of the government system, another part of society, and then somewhere else we're trying to deal with climate change. Can we look through them all and see that these have common drivers? And why might this help? Well, it might help because we see the common drivers. We will understand malnutrition in all its forms, not just obesity and undernutrition as separate issues. We might look for the double and triple duty actions. Is there something deep down that we can deal with that might have an influence on all these three things? And also, you know, I've been in this game of trying to influence the obesogenic environment for decades. And to be honest, I don't feel I'm getting very far. If my salary was dependent on reductions in the obesogenicity of our environment, I'd be a very poor person because they've been getting worse and worse. And so all of the collective pressure that have brought to bear to try and change the food system actually hasn't been working. We need to join arms, link arms, join forces with those people trying to change food insecurity in this country, trying to change food poverty, trying to change food environments for climate change. So we define this thing as the global syndemic: obesity, undernutrition, and climate change. And while obesity and undernutrition, these nutrition components, are not the totality of human health and well-being, these things, the nutrition components, and this was part of the research that we did for this Lancet Commission, these are by far, poor nutrition is by far the biggest preventable cause of ill health and premature death in every single country, including New Zealand. Most of it from non-communicable diseases, as Fuchsia pointed out, but also a lot of countries still with undernutrition. And climate change is not the totality of ecological health and well-being, but we've got to deal with that, and it's a huge part of it. And these things negatively interact, but more importantly, they have common drivers, especially right down here at the food systems. So we need to focus on the transformation of food systems. So now I'm kind of zooming in. I'm zooming in like a Google Earth here, guys, and we're going to zoom in a bit further. And when we do, and we look at the food system, we find that there's a whole lot of feedback loops here. And this is fine. This is the normal food system that we have. So we have the government down here in these governance loops. The government says, okay, these are the conditions under which you operate. And the business then creates a whole lot of supply to try to meet with demand and the customers. And this whole thing works fine. The businesses supply our foods. But the trouble is, look at this loop here, ecological loop. It's killing our environment. And over here with the health loop, it's killing our health in many ways, diabetes, obesity, and so on. And yes, there are feedback loops here. So dead people in a dead environment is not good for business. But these parallel lines across this feedback loop here indicate that there's a delay in this feedback. And so in the meantime, while people are dying, And the environment is dying because of our food system, it's not coming back and influencing how business operates. So we need stronger governance to tell businesses how they must operate so they're not doing this damage to the environment and the damage to health. And then when we zoom down even further, down to the individual level, we realized as part of this work for the Lancet Commission that the way that we normally articulate what is our responsibility for food, it's normally articulated as, well, you are responsible for the food that goes into your mouth and your children's mouth. But actually, when you zoom down here, you see, actually, we are not just eaters. We are parents, we're employees, we're customers in the food supply, we're voters of governments, we engage with the environment. We occupy many, many different roles within these levels of society. And yes, each of those levels influences us. Our family and our whānau influence us in our diets, so does what's available in the food system, so does the government, and so on. But we can influence them. And so think about these as feedback loops. So you can see that we're talking about systems all the way through, and systems are feedback loops. So our responsibilities are not just actually for what we put in our mouth, they're actually for all of the roles we play through society. And we need to transform food systems, because if you do a systems analysis on food, and you say, what is the purpose of food systems? And what is the mindset and the values that are at the heart of this? Because in systems thinking, the purpose, the mindset, the values are right at the core, because they determine the design of the system. And systems, you can't really say the food system is broken. It's not. The food systems, like every system, all work perfectly as designed. So if it's not creating the outcomes you want, go back to the design. And what is the purpose of the current food system? Two purposes: to feed people who can afford it. Notice that's feed people, not nourish them, and only those who can afford it. And it's also to provide the profits, livelihoods, and export receipts for those involved in the food provision. So it's an economic, fundamentally an economic model. And if you design your food systems based largely about economic outcomes and just feeding people who can afford it, then you get what we've got. We need to repurpose our food systems, redesign them around the environmental sustainability, human health, social equity, and economic prosperity. So this is a huge job. But there's lots written on it. There's a whole lot of documents written about how to have healthy diets. There's a whole lot of documents from the IPCC about climate change and what we need to do about that. There's a whole lot of documents now joining them up and saying we've got to deal with both of them. But the problem is all of the recommendations in these all these authoritative books and reports and things are there. There is a huge stack of them. But they're not implemented. They're just not implemented. And so we have this thing called policy inertia. We know what to do. WHO, IPCC, FAO, authoritative bodies within governments and so on, all saying similar things, but they're not happening. And why aren't they happening? Three reasons. First is industry opposition. There's gigantic industry opposition. If you want to do something about junk food, if you want to tax it, if you want to stop its marketing, if you want to get it out of schools, if you want to reduce the advertising to kids and so on, you will get huge pushback. If you want to do something about the environmental destruction that our agriculture systems have, then you get a huge pushback. That's the reason that the whole carbon trading around agriculture has been booted out to 2025. It's too hard to deal with. The farmers just roll into town and push it back. The second big problem is government's reluctance to tax and regulate. These are the two biggest tools that government have at its disposal to be able to pull the levers to influence the food system, but they don't want to do that stuff. And they don't want to, and politicians don't want to take on the battle with the food industry. So there's this chill effect. Why would you, if you're a politician, why would you go down the track of trying to deal and battle the food industry? You've got other easier wins on your plate. And so it just doesn't happen. But the third problem is a lack of public demand for these policies. You know, the public is supportive of it. You do a poll, you ask them, they're supportive, but there's just not big pressure out there. And so we need to deal with this third layer. How do we increase the public demand for policies? And that's where I think that's the sleeping giant, what we call civil society, all of the non non-profit organizations, public professional organizations, organizations like EBU, all these come together and create pressure for action. And we've seen this happen in Mexico. Mexico is the poster child for how to do this. How do you get policies? And this is a fully organized and funded campaign, funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies, actually. And they get a whole campaign together and they plan it and they work out who is on their side and they get all their allies together and they work out who are their enemies and they plot that out. And they do the marketing and the social marketing and get the messages out there. They hold a whole lot of stunts to be able to get in the on media and so on, you know, 500,000 deaths from diabetes and so on. They wheel in experts, in this case from the US. They get in front of the politicians. They produce publications. They do all the research to show the impact of it. This, to get these policies through, is a huge concerted campaign. Because of the other parts of the policy inertia. So that's what it takes for Mexico to get these policies through. It took about $12 million over 5 years from Bloomberg. It's also tough business. You know, we just finished a court case this year where three of us sued food industry, a PR guy, a dirty PR guy from tobacco, and a blogger about defamation that they took against us. So this is big business money going to dirty PR, going to defame public health advocates. And fortunately, we won that in the High Court. Michael Bloomberg's philanthropic organization isn't going to fund New Zealand. And so we've set up our own organization, not quite with the same level of dollars, unfortunately. But this is around trying to prevent harm from tobacco, alcohol, unhealthy food. And this is an advocacy organization, Health Coalition Aotearoa, which I chair. And you see here, tactically, we have included unhealthy food. This is the ultra-processed food in with tobacco and alcohol as really harmful products that need regulating and managing to produce better health, fairer outcomes, and protected children. And so one of our pieces is around unhealthy food. And this is our single piece of data that we put up around that. This is New Zealand has the second fattest children in the OECD and the EU. Plus, we have a whole lot of other problems like 8,000 odd kids having general anaesthetic to pull out rotten teeth every year from their diet. These are the three things we're asking for. We want to regulate all unhealthy food marketing to children. And fortunately, the government seems like it might be moving on that. But actually, this requires a big push from civil society to be able to get that up on the agenda. Just look at what the whole government issue is around, pressure and activity is all around COVID at the moment. Trying to get this stuff up on the government agenda is really hard work. In schools and early childhood educations, there should be no reason why they don't have healthy food and beverage policies throughout it. And they've been going at it in a relatively slow way. And the third big ask is a 20% junk food tax, especially on sugar sweetened beverage. Now, unfortunately, they've taken that off the agenda, but that is a very powerful lever. This is another part of advocacy that we've been doing every 3 years. We measure how the government is progressing, and we get about 50 or 70 researchers to rate how the government is going across about 40 indicators. We give them a scorecard, and then we say, okay, this is what you need to do. And this is the sort of the infographic around what's needed to get us there. We need a food and nutrition strategy. We need an overarching thing that'll pull all of the government organizations together. We need better infrastructure actions. We need a national nutrition survey. We haven't had one of those for decades. 2002 was the last child nutrition survey. We need to monitor, get sustainable dietary guidelines and so on. We need healthier food environments. That'll give us healthier diets, and together they'll produce these outcomes. We also talk up here about sufficient income because poverty is a big cause of unhealthy diets. This is the challenge. We did an analysis of what are the government agencies needed at the food table. 31 of them, 31 government agencies involved in food. So if you want to shift them, that is a big number. And there's no one ministry of food. There's no coordination between them. And that is a super challenge. It's really the MPI, Ministry of Primary Industries, that hold most of the food portfolio, and their main interest is in export and agriculture. Another thing I'm involved with is Aotearoa Circle and their big push. So this is a partnership between government and some private sector leaders, and they've got a big push around climate change, and one of the big three areas is around food. And this is great. This is a way of trying to get pressure on government to do something and create a food strategy. So we've developed this this framework called Manakai, and it'll be going out for consultation very shortly. And they use this crayfish basket, this crayfish trap as the symbol, if you like, that this is a woven ecosystem of food. If all the little bits need to come together to create the whole. It has health outcomes, it has economic outcomes, it has environment outcomes, it has social outcomes, and Kai is right at the center of those. And in this part of the booklet, we taken pieces from Jacinda Ardern's opening of Parliament, all the things that she wants, and actually Kai is right in the centre of them. And all of the strategies and things that that we'll be calling for that's need to be woven in this way. And so we're taking a Te Ao Māori approach, which I think is the right way to look at food. It's much more holistic than how we would look at it from a classic nutrition perspective. So that's what's happening at the national level. I just want to give you a little bit of a view about some things we're doing at the local level. This is Hawke's Bay, fruit and vegetable basket of the country, which has, in fact, the second worst nutrition statistics for the country for children, second after South Auckland. So, for example, here is obesity in preschoolers. So in preschoolers, obesity is actually trickling down now. You can see from 2011, 2012, the dark line, the black line is New Zealand, and trickling down over, still trickling down over several years. Here are the five areas within Hawke's Bay, and you can see they about 10 years ago, they were all lower than the national average, and now they're all higher than the national average. So we're probably getting not only ethnic disparities, not only socioeconomic disparities, but also urban-rural disparities in nutrition status. So we're doing a project down there called Nourishing Hawke's Bay, He Wairua Tautu Kai, which means the spirit and the food, the cultural meaning, the wider provenance and value that food gives, not just its nutrients, not just to feed you, but where does it come from? Where's the love? Where's the spirit within it? So trying to tap into those Te Ao Māori perspectives. And we did a bunch of interviews with key stakeholders, and we said, if we want to do something about improving the nutrition of this region, what do we need to take into account? And these were the pillars, the principles by which we should operate if we want to do something at a community level. Start with Mātauranga Māori, Māori knowledge. There's a lot of wisdom there. And if you want to get to Māori populations, use their own worldviews, their own stories, their own puraka, their own values, and talk about Mātauranga Māori. Bring that in from the beginning. A lot of wisdom there. Deal with children's hauora. So not just obesity, not just iron deficiency, not just whatever, deal with their wider health and talk about ho'ora in a wide sense. Deal with the food insecurity. Food insecurity is gigantic in these poor environments. You know, normally 20% of children come from food insecure households where they run out of money to be able to put food on the table. And then during COVID and lockdown, it's just skyrocketed. A lot of people living right on the margins of the bread bar, of above the bread line. And as soon as there's a problem like a lockdown, bang, up it goes and they need food parcels. Start with schools. A lot of good things starting in schools. There's this kind of thing that they see, there's a mishmash of initiatives, a whole lot of little bits and pieces. You know, bring them together, work with the community. So we had a bunch of workshops. David Tipani Leach here talking about Te Wairua Tau Te Kai with the stories. Crystal Pekapo creating the story of the Great Migration. If we want to do something about this as a region, we have to plan it, just like they planned the Great Migration to Aotearoa in the first place. And David Rees, systems scientist, bringing the systems thinking. And we had a lot of these workshops, including with Rangatahi, building the systems, showing how they can understand their own food systems and creating potential actions. And a big part of this was when we came, this was all during the lockdown and after lockdown last year, suddenly after it, Jacinda Ardern came out with this Ka Ora Ka Ako program, free school lunches. And suddenly, because this was going to affect 40% of children in Hawke's Bay, now 40% of children in Hawke's Bay are going to get free school lunches. Yeah, it's the most 25% disadvantaged schools across the country, but because Hawke's Bay is relatively deprived, it's 40% of kids. That is the biggest nutrition intervention that we have seen in children since I've been in this game. And it's huge, and it has a lot of potential to create all of those things in that box there from the Ministry of Education, improving well-being, development, learning, concentration, school attendance, financial hardship, barriers to participation in education, overall health, and so on. So actually, it's interesting, this one program, which started off as a food insecurity issue. It started off because they didn't want kids to go to school hungry. And then when COVID came and they need to spend money in the post-COVID recovery, Jacinda Ardern put it into this, a couple of $100 million over a few years. Then it expanded in its purpose. So if they take on those purposes, then we are getting close to what we were talking about before, about what the purpose of a food system is. So just to wrap up here, people's diets, which we're all concerned about, our own diets and others' diets, is highly dependent on the food environments, on what's available, the cost, the price, the availability, how much it's marketed, and so on. And what's in our food environments, what's in our supermarkets, what we have available to us, is highly dependent on the design of those food systems that create those environments. And that's highly dependent on the underlying purpose of the food systems, why we set up in the first place. And as I said, the primary underlying purpose of the current food systems is economic. The global syndemic, we put that out there as a new mental model so that you can look past the obesity, the undernutrition and food insecurity and the climate change issues and look all the way through to the food systems and see how they're connected right deep down within the systems. We need the collective action of civil society to transform these food systems, and that's what Health Coalition Aotearoa is about. It's what the Aotearoa Circle is about. It's what Nourishing Hawke's Bay is about, this collective action, and it's true for a lot of organisations. So we're trying to influence food policies, strategies at the high level, at the government level, as well as trying to influence community efforts. And the way that we're doing it, the way that we're testing it out, is combining two different sets of knowledge, systems science and mātauranga Māori. And if we can bring those together successfully, then I think we will really have a whole new set of paradigms through which to engage community. So kia ora tato, I'll finish there. And thanks very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Excellent. That was really great, Boyd. Thank you very much for your contribution. I can be heard, can't I? Yep, I can. Quick question, anybody? Hands up, usual thing. Just in the direction down the bottom there, you can just hit a raised hand model. I'm just doing a quick look now to see if anybody has a raised hand. Doesn't look like it. Maybe a question for me, Boyd. Big challenge there. What's one thing evidence-based eating could do? What could we do as a small organization? Give us a hint.
Well, you're already doing a bit by being part of Health Coalition Aotearoa grant. And, you know, that logo that's up behind you, there's another 60-odd logos of organisations, health organisations, NGOs, professional organisations who lend their logo and their efforts to it. And honestly, I think it's by this collective voice that really is likely to get it. I mean, if government is going to try to engage with the civil society about food, who are they going to go to? You know, where are they going to come to get some collective view? And I think by pulling people together and having a platform by which we can come together, I think that gives us a much, much stronger voice in government. And I think this government, you know, to give them their due, they've done bugger all, to be honest, Grant, about food, apart from this Ka Ora Ka Ako program. But, you know, they've done bold stuff. And if you just look at the health reforms, that's pretty bold stuff. What's coming through in the smoke-free 2025, the policies they're putting up, that's really bold stuff as well. What they've done for COVID, that's bold stuff. I just want them to be bold about food as well. And it was interesting, you know, Grant, we just had a couple of weeks ago the UN Food System Summit. And this was this huge global movement type of thing that ended up at the UN on the 23rd of September. And the New Zealand government, you know, stood up like all other countries and said what it was going to do out of all of the possible things it could do. And it came down to two things. It just chose two things that it said it was going to focus on. One was reducing agricultural emissions. Greenhouse gas emissions, and I think they're probably thinking technology. But the other one was using Indigenous knowledge to help us get out of this pickle. And I think that's great. That's something we can really grab a hold of, the Mataranga Māori, those Tau Māori views, which are much more holistic and I think give us a lot of handles to grab a hold of.
Yeah. I agree, and there's a lot of young Māori who are actually leading the way in that at the moment too, so maybe we should get behind them and support them as well.
Yeah.
Indeed. Or again, Boyd, thank you very much.
There's just one question in the chat there that I just might quickly answer because it's come from a medical student.
Please.
Fantastic that you got medical students in here. I teach the population health intensive, try to open up their eyes to population nutrition. Doctors and nutrition is a great group to get a part of. And the voice of doctors, you know, doctors are given a super privileged role in society. And if doctors can come out and use that privileged position and that privileged voice to actually call for these things, I think that is going to be really powerful. So, you know, both as medical students, you've got your own journal now. You can join these groups. But when you come out as doctors, lend your privileged voice to trying to get this holistic approach.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.